All right, welcome back to another episode of Perfusion. Today we've got Justin Gimelstab as our guest. I've been a fan of Gimelstab for years. The first time that you really hit my radar, I guess, was when you'd have to remind me exactly, was when you gave a speech. I think it was like in your last match. Was it your last tennis match where you gave a speech at the end of the match?
Yeah, I mean, it turned into a speech. It was I was retiring at the US Open. I think it was 2007, and I lost to Roddick in the first round. And we had a good relationship, still do. And yeah, I grew up on the East Coast, and a big part of me playing tennis was because of the US Open, how amazing of a event it was and how exciting it was and what I aspired to. So, you know, it wasn't right in my backyard, but it was pretty close. And I've been going there since I was young, and I had not always, but played pretty well there over the years. Anyway, so to play my last match on center court at night against Roddick, who by then, you know, was by far the best American. And played pretty decent considering where my game was at the time, having just come back from back surgery. And during my rehab for my back surgery and also previous foot surgery, I'd done some TV and some broadcasting and some interviewing and stuff. So I guess someone had tipped off, I think it was USA at the time, USA Network, and Michael Barkan, that I wanted to get into broadcasting. So they did something kind of unconventional. And it was completely impromptu. Not everyone believes it. Some people think it was set up or staged or predetermined. It wasn't. No one had told me at all. And Michael Barkan, who was a total gentleman and great, gave me the mic and basically had me interview Andy, you know, on live national TV. And it ended up just, depending on how you look at it, either regressing, digressing, or, you know, hamming it up, just kind of reverting back to, you know, us just being us and talking and joking around and making fun of each other. And I was making fun of myself. He was making fun of me. And we just kind of held court on, you know, like we would do, like it was just us, but it was on live TV and in a national audience. And it led to a lot of opportunities. It was fun and funny. People responded well to it. And I ended up launching my TV broadcasting career and getting a gig with the Tonight Show and then Tennis Channel and then some other stuff. But it was a very serendipitous. And it was, I think the reason it played so well is because it was actually authentic and organic. But I think I also had benefited from some reps I had around TV and broadcasting when I was injured. And that's something that I like to talk to athletes about, in terms of being opportunistic when you're actually playing. I know it's tough because you're obviously trying to get, you know, blood from a stone from your body and your career. But, you know, generally the biggest opportunities are going to come when you have the biggest platform, which is when you're playing. So, you know, just take advantage of whether it's relationships or people that you meet or people that want to meet you, or just trying new things or just things that are made available to you because of your situation and your access. So anyway, it worked out. It was a nice moment.
Yeah. You killed it. If it was a mic drop, right? I should have watched it before this, and it just came to my mind just now. How I'd heard of you, I'd seen you, you know, on the tour. I'm a big tennis guy myself. And I think I met you a few times over the years as well. But that speech, I should have re-listened to it, but that speech was like, man, this guy is it was hilarious. You killed it. And then, yeah, I was happy that it parlayed into, you know, post career. What year was that, by the way?
2007.
07. Okay. Yeah. So I'm going to rewatch that after this. But so so you were on the Tonight Show. You worked for the Jay Leno? You was that what did you do there?
Yeah, I did like Man on the Street type of stuff. There was some fun segment. She got a little unlucky. I did a segment about the U.S. Open. Came on the show, presented it. Once again, I think it was pretty funny. And then, unfortunately, got unlucky. I was signed a deal to do a bunch more segments, and then the writer's strike hit, and it kind of lost momentum, and then I went more to the sports side. But I would say I was fortunate during my TV broadcasting career to work for a lot of different people, and I think that's also interesting. I mean, one of the things in life that I think is important is sometimes the easiest way to figure out what you do want to do is to realize what you don't want to do, right? So trying a bunch of different things in your career, in your professional life. So in TV, I mean, I did all different types of TVs. And obviously, I knew my meat and potatoes would be, or hopefully be in tennis if I got opportunities. But like, you know, I did red carpets. I did hosting. I did, you know, news shows. I did sports radio. I did CNN. I did Fox Sports Radio. I did, you know, I did pure hosting stuff. I did, you know, I produced content. So, you know, I think I hosted an interview show. I mean, I think that was, you know, being able to learn all different sides of the broadcasting business and really actually trying to learn the broadcasting business. I think a lot of athletes just kind of, especially in the beginning, just think broadcasting, okay, they just show up and talk about what they see, right? But there's so many more moving parts with TV and production. One of the best lessons I learned early on was, you know, how much respect you have to have for the truck, right? The truck is, you know, you have the people in there doing yeoman's work. You know, they're working twice as long as you, twice as hard as you, and one-tenth as glamorous. But I had a lot of good mentors in TV, fortunately. And I was always kind of a seeker. I remember one time I finagled my way to sit next to the late, great Dick Enberg on a flight to Australia just to pick his brain. And I already had like a reel ready to ask him for, you know, his views on it. And the poor guy, I could just see in his eyes, he's like, wow, I better do this early because I got a 14-hour flight with this guy. And he does not see, you know. He was sweet, but like Mary Carrillo, Ted Robinson, Leif Shiras was, you know, he was incredibly supportive and helpful. Remember Leif Shiras would always tell me, wear striped ties. They always look better on camera. And I always remember that. So I had a lot of really good mentors and supporters in TV. But it's like anything else. You got to really learn it. It's a craft. I mean, obviously, some people might be predisposed to being more comfortable on camera or talking, but in terms of, you know, the timing and, you know, camera angles and there's more to it. And I think one of the great disservices that people do in life in all areas is that when you're good at something, you make it look easy. But, you know, as we know, it's not. And pursuing, you know, being excellent and being elite at things is not easy or comfortable.
Well, you were elite. You were at the highest level in the tennis commentating for many years, right? And I want to and you hit a rough patch, right? Yeah.
If we're going to be brutally honest, I mean, which.
Well, who hasn't hit a rough patch in their life, right?
Yeah. I think that's one way to look at it. And also, my life completely imploded. I mean, but, you know, it's, you know, some of the things were due to my responsibility and some of them were just a confluence of events of getting mixed up with some, you know, people with bad motives but it all kind of started when, you know, it really started when, I mean, I, like everyone knows, so a lot of these things are public, they're just not, the facts aren't public, the facts or the interpretation of it unfortunately aren't, but Yeah, I went through a very, very acrimonious divorce, unfortunately, which isn't far from the only person to do that. But mine was, like most things in my life, very extreme and unfortunate. Had, you know, obviously the most amazing blessing come out of it. My beautiful son, Brandon, that, you know, is everything in my life. And then my father passed away very suddenly out of you know, without a lot of warning. And he was such an important part of my life. I mean, we had a very connected relationship, and that was just, you know, that was a lot. So a lot was building up. I was working very hard at a lot of different roles in sports and business. I mean, I was on the board of directors for the ATP. I was running a production company. I was doing a ton of live television for Tennis Channel. I was coaching John Isner off and on, or I had been, I wasn't, but I was still helping a little bit. And I would say
you had it all.
Well, look, that's an interesting way to look at it. Perception isn't always reality, and sometimes having it all takes different shape and meaning, right? Like, it might have seemed that way, but at that moment, it certainly didn't feel like that. I mean, I had a lot. So I think that's an interesting delineation, is like having it all and having a lot aren't necessarily the same. I definitely had a lot, and I definitely had a lot of stuff that I loved, which I did. But managing it all and balancing it all and finding balance and the healthy balance in your life, you know, that's always been a little challenging, because I'm such a very ambitious, and I'm very curious. But, you know, going back to, you know, so I definitely, in theory, was at the top of everything, definitely professionally and financially and, you know, all those things that everyone in theory strives for. But I was dealing with a lot, you know, internally and emotionally at that time. And then with the combination of my dad passing, and then I got in this really unfortunate altercation fight on Halloween in 2018, just, you know, a couple of days after burying my dad, and unfortunate situation with a guy who had been a real antagonist and someone who is, you know, in my opinion, took advantage of the situation, antagonizing me. And look, I made a mistake. I wish I didn't engage the way I did, and I regret that and always will. But what came out of it was something was just shocking. I mean, you know, just, and quite honestly, I never really looked at all the stuff that they perpetuated. I just kind of put my head down, tried to protect my relationship with my son, deal with the passing of my father, you know, take care of my mom, figure out what was going on with the family's business, and just basically duck and weave to all these crazy, ridiculous allegations that were going on. But the past bunch of years, I've seen some of the stuff that was been perpetuated, and it was very hurtful and shocking. And obviously it was incredibly damaging. Almost none of it is true.
Yeah, I mean, they can put anything in court documents. They can write.
That's amazing that you know that. Maybe it's not amazing that you know that. It's refreshing that you know that, but it's so shocking that either other people don't know it. What's even more shocking is there are people that do know it that pretend they don't. And a lot of them are journalists. And I will say this, what's going to be revealed in the next bunch of months is how, and this is, once again, I don't want to get political. I'm not very politically savvy, and I don't want to get into that. But what's most interesting, and it's kind of the same thing why the PGA settled with LIV, discovery and litigation reveals a lot. And a lot of people avoid litigation because they're afraid of discovery. And some people go to litigation because it's the only way to prove their point, because they deserve certain things in discovery. And if you ask anyone in sports business, they know the reason the PGA is even considered or is going to partner with LIV is because they did not want to deal with the discovery. Anyone knows that. But what you said is really interesting, Andrew. It's a lot of, you know, we don't know each other very well. We've communicated sometimes. I have a lot of respect for the way you said that. That's exactly what people, you could put anything you want in a court document, but what, so then you, so, but it's gone shifted in this country. Like, it's like, that's what our whole country was based on in terms of, you know, it is that you actually have to, there's a difference between an allegation and evidence and a finding. And, you know, unfortunately, I didn't know that much about the law before all my family law stuff. Now, unfortunately, you know, I feel like I'm a, you know, it's like, it's unfortunately become a huge part of my life, but like, and you know, sorry not to bounce around, but it was really interesting. I'm pretty friendly with the commissioner of the NBA, Adam Silver, who's the most special guy. And, you know, he was in the beginning of the season, he was on TV with the TNT crew. He did an interview and, you know, all the normal stuff. And then at the end, like, he kind of, Charles Barkley, who I like, and he's entertaining and all that, but like, out of nowhere, Charles Barkley kind of like ambushes Commissioner Silver, being like, you know, what are we doing about all the, you know, I don't paraphrase it, whether domestic violence or, you know, or acts of violence with all the players. The NBA needs to be number one in how they handle, you know, violence and all these things. And like, the commissioner, you know, it was a complete non sequitur, and it was obviously Barkley was grandstanding. And it was so interesting. The commissioner didn't skip a beat, didn't get emotional. He just said, well, actually, it's not a competition. We don't need to be the best at it. We just need to do what's right. And by the way, we need to be able to differentiate between, and once again, I'm paraphrasing, but the we need to be able to differentiate between allegations, evidence, and, you know, and what really happened. You know, people in the public eye, especially the way social media and the cancel culture, I mean, you become very, very big targets. And by the way, there are legitimate victims out there, and I would never want to, you know, to minimize anyone that has actually been a legitimate victim. That's not in the slightest, you know, not in the slightest, but it's amazing. I mean, and what going back to what I said is, I think one of the problems and one of the reasons why there's such, you know, political unrest or such extremes is that, like, there's such a lack of trust in the media now. I mean, you know, it's like, it's, you know, the media has its own agenda, and, you know, the media is supposed to be, you know, it's supposed to be one of the big responsibilities is, like, it's almost like a financial person has a fiduciary duty, right? To, like, you know, not just sell you products or do things that benefit them, right? That you hear that all the time, like the fiduciary, you're like, you know, it used to be thought that the media had, you know, a borderline fiduciary right to kind of really seek out the truth, not perpetuate its own agenda or motives or, you know, initiatives. And like, that's been probably the most amazing part. And by the way, in my case, we have a civil trial, you know, next year, where I am very, I would say look forward to it, or excited, because you never want to deal with litigation. And it's a harrowing process, and it's emotional, and takes so much of your time and energy and finances and resources, and puts so much pressure on everyone around you that you care about. But, you know, I am very excited, quote unquote excited, not in looking forward to having actual facts come out, you know, documents, you know, empirical evidence, pictures, emails, videos, timestamps, geolocations, you know, and also testimony under penalty of perjury. Like, that's a big difference. Like, that's the other part people don't understand. Like, you know, is, you know, real evidence and then findings, not just people saying something that's, you know, complete hearsay and irrelevant, or where they don't have consequences, or in a manipulated window, right, of how and why they're saying it, or, you know. So it's just, like I said, I wouldn't wish it on anyone. But it's part of my journey. And, you know, I am a believer that, I mean, in a crazy way, I tell people this. And by the way, I'm not a believer in like everything happens for a reason. Like that whole, like, I think that's too easy of a cop out, you know, but, you know, to basically get canceled at the height of where I was doing stuff that I love. That's the biggest thing that bums me out. Is like, I loved all that stuff that I did. And I thought I was pretty good at a lot of it.
You were, yeah.
To basically, yeah. I wasn't fishing there for a compliment. That part's subjective. Like, that's the beauty of sports. Sports is complete meritocracy. Sport, you know, the rest is, you know, you can do the same thing and some people can think you're great or not. It's not, you know, in that business, it's just, you know, it's, you know, there's a big range, but I enjoyed it. And, you know, to get basically canceled at that stage of your life, hopefully I have a lot of life left, knock on wood, but, you know, you learn a lot about people and your relationships and friendships and loyalty and, you know, human nature, you know, because obviously, you know, when you have a lot more going on and you're a lot more successful and quote unquote powerful, you know, it changes relationship dynamics. And, you know, it's been learned a lot over the past 5 years now almost. And, you know, I'm hoping to get back into the sports business world. I love that. I'm proud of the work we've done, you know, taking over my father's insurance business, FBR Group, which, you know, provided every opportunity for our whole family. And so I have a lot of pride and respect for that. And it's a great business. And a lot of it's very applicable with sports and entertainment, athletes and entertainers, that, you know, with everything that's going on with taxes and estate planning and the tax benefits of insurance products. I kind of like to think of it as financial solutions with the tax benefits of insurance. And that's really what we specialize, especially with high net worth people, individuals. So, but I would love to get back into sports, and I've had some opportunities, and hopefully I'll have more, and hopefully I have a lot more, if the case resolves the right way, which I,
What is this case? Is it the Halloween case? Is it the marriage? Yeah,
it's a civil case. Yeah. The family law case is done. The family law case is done.
The Halloween case?
Yeah, it's civil. So all the criminal stuff has been resolved and expunged. I pled no contest, to a misdemeanor. Which was my belief that I should take responsibility for engaging in the altercation. I didn't provoke it. I didn't initiate it, but I did engage in it, and that's on me. I did, my community labor.
So is the civil case going to be closed out soon? Is that what's going on?
No, the civil case is going to be next year. So that's where, you know, we have some dueling suits, but I think the most significant part, definitely from my perspective, is the, you know, I don't know all the legal terms, but essentially basically the interference with all my professional stuff and basically just misrepresenting everything that happened that ended up creating.
Oh, so you're suing them.
Yeah. They're suing me too, but let's counter. I mean, because I know the truth and what actually happened, I don't pay a lot of merit to their claims, but I think I have very strong claims on and very strong evidence on what they did to create something that was just fiction.
Man, I hope you can put that behind you soon. I had something similar happen with our family. My wife was in a car accident, and then, you know, it was a bad one. And then they, in the court documents, they can say whatever they want, which is crazy. And I wasn't involved at all. And I'm in the documents, and I think that's a crime in itself. Like, oh, you can say whatever you want, but if they're saying lies, they're lying in court documents. Isn't lying, like, and that's public. So that was mind blowing that you can.
No, it's weird. It's crazy. Like, and then there's all these weird legal privileges. Like, you can't also, like, you know, there's different standards for defamation if you're a public figure. There's different standards for liability if something is in a legal, you know, a brief or a, you know, it's
not a good process for people's mental health is the bottom line, because it affects people's mental health when I think they call it gaslighting now. That's more of a modern day term. Like, you're saying things are true when they weren't true or not reality.
Yeah, I think it's also just, I mean, look, there's a, because of the accessibility of information, you know, there's, look, every system has flaws, right? And you know, this, unfortunately, not everyone has the greatest motives. And like I said, there's ways to weaponize it. And I think that's what kind of you're referring to, is people manipulating the system and weaponizing it. But like I said,
you get ambitious lawyers who are willing to say anything.
Yeah. I mean, look, every profession has its flaws and its, you know, kind of blind spots, but look, it's just life. I don't believe life is linear. Excuse me. I don't believe life is linear. And a big part of it is, like, we talk about the journey and the process and learning from mistakes and trying to live your best life and trying to be a good person and trying to have good relationships, and people make mistakes and you learn and you grow, and also you forgive other people and you try and view things with empathy. And I've had a lot of blessings in my life and I've had a bunch of challenges. Like, that's just kind of like the, you know, the box of chocolates that it's been. But I'll keep battling to try and live my best life no matter what has, you know, transpired or what will transpire. It's just trying to be present and trying to, you know, live an authentic life. But, you know, it's you've obviously experienced it on the, you know, a little bit on the legal side to some degree, but it's, once again, you need a system in place that has the ability to protect victims, true victims. So, you know, but there are, unfortunately, I've been on the other side of the system being incredibly, incredibly manipulated.
Right. Yeah.
And some bad journalists. I mean,
I can't even imagine being. Wait,
that's like, you know, I mean, when you go through thousands and thousands of discovery documents, of documents that people don't think you'll ever see, I mean, and you see how the proverbial sausage is made, you know, in terms of how some of these stories got written and why they got written and what these people's agendas and motives and how they handled it. I mean, I'll leave it to the hearing or eventually to get out of it, but there's some, you know, there's some journalists and some people within the system and the establishment that will definitely, definitely be exposed for being very, very unethical and, you know, and give credence to why people have lost so much faith in journalism.
Well, I hope you fight back and get into sports, whether it's even NBA. Oh, that's
a tough word. Let's not say fight back.
Persevere.
Work back and
persevere back. Listening to A-Rod, a video on A-Rod recently, and how, you know, because he had the Ped scandal, he had numerous scandals as well, and he could have easily fallen off at some point, and he kept pushing back and kept pushing and kept pushing, and eventually, you know, now he's still. He's out there. He's everywhere. He's commentating. He's on Shark Tank. He's doing everything. But he's part owner of the
Minnesota Timberwolves.
Yeah, he fought back. I don't know what word you use there, but he persevered.
I'm just saying, at the second, if I ever wrote anything, what this is also the crazy word. If I ever wrote anything on social media that says, like, you could imagine, you know, that's the unfortunate part. I think that there's a lot of value to where technology has gone, but there's been some downside. And I will say, like, you know, generally social media is not an example of the rising of the tides. Generally, it's the lowest common denominator, not the highest, right? I mean, I know there's an excellent function for it, especially for public people and, you know, and a lot of value and stuff. But, you know, I was just being cheeky. If I ever wrote that word, you know, associated with any form of redemption, it would get jumped on.
Well, yeah. Well, let's circle. Yeah. You're 6'5" guy. You're like lethal to begin with. So just you're a nice guy, but let's circle back. You were a winner basically for, you know, all through your childhood. You were a singles champion as a junior, like number one in America for, I don't know, countless years. Is that accurate, or you were up there?
Yeah, I had a good junior career, very good junior career. Very good junior career. I was a national champion a bunch, you know, when essentially all the age groups, 14, right. 16, 18, college, I was good. But I like to say, look, I'm not saying this to be self-deprecating, but like I had like a, I think it's a paradox, you know, like an average professional career, but, you know, as a professional athlete, you know, proud of it. Like anyone in anything always wishes they did better or would have done it differently if they knew more or could have do it again, all those type of things. But like, I'm proud of my career, but I also love, I wasn't going to hang around a lot, you know, when I knew I couldn't really compete at the highest level because I really was excited about pursuing other things afterward. But yeah, I had a good career. Tennis has given me a lot. I love tennis. I still do. I still love hitting balls. I hit balls yesterday or maybe 2 days ago. And I'm fortunate. My brother lives right down the street and he's got a nice tennis court. So I go over there and play sometimes. So, you know, I love the sport. I think it's, I tell people all the time. I think tennis and tennis players are some of the best athletes in the world. Not me, but, and I wasn't, but in terms of when you think of all the different things they have to do physically, mentally, all the different types of physicality. I mean, fast twitch, endurance, you know, all different muscles, then the technical, the mental, the individual, the international, the year long, you know, it's just, you know, it's psychological. I mean, there's so much that goes into it. For example, I think Djokovic is the best athlete in the world right now. I think he's been the best athlete, overall athlete in the world for a long time. And, you know, so I've got tremendous respect for, and I love the sport. I love watching the sport. I just think it's beautiful.
So what do you think it takes today to play professionally? What does it take?
You have to be a great athlete. You can't, unfortunately, you have to be a great mover. I mean, you can't, it's just, you, technology is kind of even the playing field in terms of with technique, you know, you can get away with more. It's like back in the day when the rackets weren't as powerful, that a smaller sweet spot, maybe, you know, you could, like, I guess the analogy like in golf is with, they'll say like gain strokes on the field, like, you know, and putting or driving or your iron play, right? Like in tennis, you can maybe previously you could have gained some strokes on the field, you know, with your technique or your, you know, more strategy. Now, physically, like if you're not at a certain level, like you can't make up that math because they're just too good of athletes. Like they're just the movement and the defense, the amount of quality shots. And also, so that's like with the equipment and courts have slowed down and, you know, it's just, you can't just very hard unless you're John Isner win points with one or two shots, right? So in a long-winded answer, which are generally my answers, movement. I mean, movement, athleticism, speed. Yeah.
Who do you think is the best up and coming? Because America, you know, it's like we have this huge gap, right? Roddick got a win. I think it was in 2003. And we're kind of in a, you know, we haven't had we have the women's, the Williams sisters, and you were close with Venus. You won a couple championships with her, Australian Open and French mixed doubles. Congrats. Who do you think the best up and coming is the trophy there?
Yeah, it's the French Open one here. Oh.
Wait, it's so little. I thought it'd be bigger, but.
Let's stay away from that.
But who do you think is the best up and coming American player that might have a shot at, you know, might have a shot at?
I think American tennis said, look.
Or are we just out? Is Americans just out?
No, I think, no, I don't think so at all. I was actually talking to one of the USTA coaches, my old coach, who's a great guy, David Nankin, yesterday. We've got so many Americans. We got strength in numbers. I mean, I think we have the most Americans in the top 100, and on men's side, on the top 100. I mean, obviously in our country, we expect Grand Slam champions, and we haven't had that since Roddick. But, I mean, Taylor Fritz now has two years in the top 10. You have Tiafoe's in the top 10. You have Tommy Paul was close to the top 10. You have, obviously, Sebastian Korda, who's a great talent. I mean, Shelton broke through, and he's an incredibly dynamic, exciting player who seemingly has weapons to keep ascending, and great attitude, great energy, great charisma, great genetics. I mean, his dad was a stud player. Ryan Shelton actually played against him a couple times, and a great coach. But his uncle, Todd Witzkin, who unfortunately passed away, was also a great player, a great athlete. So, you know, he has the lot going for him in lineage and genetics there and surroundings. I think that any one of them could, you know, I think they all will continue to improve and have chances to keep getting better and better. There's a kid that I saw this summer, Alex Mickelson, I think is really, really good. It's another kid that went to Georgia, Quinn, who is really good. I think there's a lot of good American players. I think they've done a really good job. And, you know, I just think sometimes they're just graded harshly or judged harshly because for a while, you know, with Agassi and Sampras and McEnroe and Connors and, you know, there's so many Grand Slam champions. But, you know, it's kind of the same with basketball, right? Like the sport just got more international. I mean, priorities in other countries grew with tennis became even bigger and bigger in a lot of the other countries. So I think, and on the women's side, obviously it's great. I mean, with Coco Gauff winning the US Open, I love the Jessica Pegula story. I mean, I think that is just one of the great stories because, you know, people don't generally root for the very, very wealthy, right? Like, especially in a sport that's so tough and so, you know, it's very easy to be like, oh, well,
well, do people know she's very, very wealthy, though?
Like, so, no, I mean, her family is or whatever. But regardless of that, my point is I just love the fact that her game is based on such foundational technical effort, physicality, strategy, repetition, you know, being so solid. Like, you know, she's worked at her game. Like, she wasn't like she jumped, you know, she was – you know, kind of a journey woman player for a while, and she just stuck with it and got better and learned and improved. And like, I think it's an amazing story. And, you know, a lot of times people don't associate people with opportunity of being maximizers or because it's just, you know, they have more opportunities. But I'm a big believer in it's not about success is about maximizing your opportunity, regardless of whatever that is. You know, it's not, I don't know that it's necessarily more, someone is technically more successful if they get to 10 in the world or 20 in the world or 200 in the world based on what their potential was and what their opportunity was and how they maximize it. It's kind of like what you said in the beginning about, you know, what happened 5 years ago, like how, you know, I don't know how you phrase it, but basically how great things were, how successful I was versus how much I had. Like, I don't know, you know, they're not always the same, right? And other people's perception of it isn't always, you know, it's often not accurate. So, you know, I think there's a lot of nice stories on the American tennis side. But it is, you know, it is tough. The Grand Slam singles titles at the highest level, it's, you know, it's rarefied air.
Well, you got two.
Yeah, but not real ones. I mean, not real
who
ones.
Who carried who? Did you carry Venus or did she carry you?
I'm assuming that's a rhetorical question. That being said, about the Australian Open was the first pro tournament she won in any capacity, but she was obviously you could tell she was special, and she definitely carried me. It was funny. We actually beat Serena in the finals of the French Open. That was a little awkward, but they were poised to be. They were so special right from the get. You could tell that they were just different, but they were awesome. And that was really a neat time. But that, I mean, technically the Grand Slams, but it's a completely. We talk about Grand Slam champions. Absolutely do not deserve to be put in that class.
See, that's why you're a good commentator. You keep it real.
Yeah, I believe what I believe, and I'm not, you know, I'm not afraid to say it. I think I've learned as I've gotten older, or just to maybe be a little bit more conscious of all the, especially today's day and age, conscious of all the ramifications of how everything could be interpreted and the sensitivities. Let's put it that way. But I heard this great quote that I rely on all the time. It's just the definition of a genius is someone that could learn from someone else's mistakes, right? Most of the time, fortunately, human nature, you got to learn from your own.
Yeah. Yeah. I think with age, right, the older you get, you can kind of see the patterns and say, okay, I should learn from that and how to learn from it and pull a lesson from it.
Well, patterns, I think, are really important. I agree with you there. Pattern, you know, understanding patterns, your own patterns, other people's patterns. I'm a big believer in sociology, psychology, how they're all connected, human nature, genetics, nurture, nature, all that stuff. I'm fascinated by all that stuff.
You feel like a philosopher.
Me?
Yeah.
No, maybe just a searcher. I think maybe more just someone who's kind of trying to just appreciate and surrender to the journey as opposed to just the result and the process, I think. And that's maybe something I've worked on. That's and more of that. Like, I don't want to be, and by the way, no different than, I mean, I struggle with staying in the present and not looking back, not looking forward. Friend of mine and I always kind of talk and joke around with each other about not forward tripping, you know. So it's like, but not going back and not going forward, it's not easy to do, but you know, it's it's tough to be at peace or happy if you're not present, right? And like, that's, and by the way, that's, you know, that's not an easy state to achieve, and definitely not one that I've always been great at.
Do you see yourself getting back into this? I think you mentioned it before, before the podcast, getting back into sports. Is that, do you see yourself doing that, or do you see yourself staying?
I hope so. I mean, you know, that part of the world isn't a meritocracy, right? You need people to give you opportunities, and you need people to feel confident that if they give you those opportunities, it's going to work out and reflect well on them. And then you're going to do, you know, take, you know, it's a responsibility, and that you'll be able to, you know, whether it's do good work or wherever, you know, I mean, I guess in to simplify it, I mean, yeah, I love, my heart and soul is in sports. I believe in sports. I think the meritocracy nature of sports relative to everything else in the world is why it's recession proof. I think whether people know it or not, they always are going to gravitate to something real. I think that, and I love that about sports, and I love it's all revealed out there, and, you know, and I love sports. I love content. I love production and media and people and being out there. So yeah, I really miss that part of it, but we'll see. I hope I get opportunities again. I hope I do.
What's it like beating Andre Agassi?
I mean, it was awesome. We played a bunch of times, but we used to practice together all the time. Just coincidentally, one of the first matches that I played as a pro, I played him at UCLA, and he was going through one of his dips, and, you know, I got the better of him. But I like to say that was the biggest mistake I made, because he took it out on me the next bunch of matches. But it was great. I mean, he's obviously an icon in the sport, and, you know, we've had a very close personal relationship, which has been a real blessing. He's a very special guy. Also, I think what makes him so special is that, I mean, he's got tremendous empathy, and he's got tremendous authenticity, but also he doesn't purport to have it all figured out. He knows he's on his own journey, and he's, you know, learned from mistakes and trying to get better in everything he does. But you don't see a lot of people at that stature that are that dialed into other people. And he, you know, as he is incredible in that way. And very, so very special. But yeah, it's fun playing him. Even, I mean, when he was on, you know, it was such a suffocating feeling, because you just get the ball on you so quickly, you know, and take your time away and control the middle of the court and, hurt you off both sides in the return, and he was suffocating.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking, how does one player get better than another player in tennis, in your opinion?
Well,
is it just God given? Is it practice? Is it?
Excuse me. Yeah, I think. I mean, I am a believer that there are some just genetically gifted or superior people, practice, technique, you know, the mental side, the physical side, but I mean, tennis, there is a big technical side and repetition and muscle memory. And then there's getting in position, you know, so there's the physical side, there's the mental side. That's the thing about tennis. There's all different parts. And, you know, if anyone, you're only as good as your weakest link, right? Like if your movement is off, okay, how good your technique is, it's going to be compromised if you're not in position. Okay, how good you move, if your technique is off, you're going to be exposed off with certain shots. You know, if mentally you're not great, I don't care how good your technique and movement is, it could affect those. So, you know, everything's in play.
Do you think if you were 6 foot, you would have been as good as you are?
No. But maybe I would have been faster. I don't know. You know, I'm also a believer that, you know, you build adaptation.
But you have the wingspan, so you don't need the speed necessarily, right?
Well, it would have been helpful. It would have been helpful if I was faster, definitely. But, you know, it's like I like to think that self-preservation is a great form of motivation, right? Like that's how you develop adaptations based on survival. So I don't know. Maybe I would have been faster. Who knows? Maybe I just would have been selling insurance earlier. I don't know.
So what advice, I mean, for, you know, I got a kid, he's 8 years old. Do you have any advice for training for him? You know, I've got my own opinions. I did not get as far as you. I got as far as futures, but, you know, and you guys, your brother Russell was more in our age group. I think he went to Newark Academy. Is that where you went as well? Did you go to Newark?
I did.
Yeah, you guys would win state. Regularly.
Great school. Yeah, great school. Just look, I think it's important to expose kids to all different sports, team sports, individual sports, different athletic. I mean, it's on the sports side.
Did you play multiple sports, or were you just a tennis?
Yeah, I played basketball, baseball. I did. And I think kids playing different sports. And it's going to sound hokey, but, you know, you want it to be fun, because then they're going to want to do it more. But also, I do think there's a technical component to every sport or every where you want to make sure they have the right foundation, because that's the impediment later on if they do like something where they can't improve, because muscle memory is a bear and it's real. Like to undo muscle memory takes so much more. It's like learning a foreign language. Your aptitude every day on this earth decreases as you get older. It's the same thing with technique. Like it's much easier to get it right from the beginning and try and change it later. So that's the only thing I would say, no matter what it is. Like, I was a decent baseball player, but I didn't know that much about baseball. So when my son got into baseball, like, you try and make sure, whether I studied it or got him with the right coaching, just to make sure that if he, you know, the way he throws, the way he hits, learns the game the right way, you know, just, you want to give, look, any parent, you want to give your kids, whatever it is, school, relationships, health, fitness, sports, you want to give them the best chance to be successful, right?
Yeah. How old is Brandon?
10.
Okay. Does he play tennis?
Plays a little bit of tennis, plays a lot of baseball, plays a little bit of basketball, plays a little bit of flag football. But he's a good boy. Proud of him.
Well, probably have the height for pitching.
Yeah, he'll be tall. Yeah, he's definitely going to be tall. He's a big boy for sure. Yeah, he is. He's a good boy.
All right. Well, shoot. Anything else you got? Anything else you got here before we wrap it up?
Well, no, this was nice. It's look forward to another good year of tennis 2024. There'll be some fun storylines to look out for, but I enjoyed it. I appreciate you having me on, and I think hopefully there'll be some some good things, some relevant things in 2024. I'm hoping and believe hopefully a good year and with some opportunities in the sports business space that I've been missing. So,
are you going to go to any of the tournaments? Have you been going to the Grand Slams?
I went to the U.S. Open last year when John retired and brought my son. That was really fun, really nice experience. And that was nice. And I think I'll be going to more tournaments. I usually go to Indian Wells. I'm good friends with Tommy Haas, the tournament director, and Ray Moore. And that's, I could drive there. That's an amazing tournament that they've built. So I've been to a couple, but I think I'll be at more in 2024.
Is Tommy still married to that actress?
Sarah Foster?
Yeah.
Yeah, they have two beautiful daughters. I spoke to Tommy last night. He's awesome. That's an example of relationships in tennis. Like, we started playing against each other when we were 12, and now we're 46. I mean, it's 34 years, and our relationship, you know, we've already had a good relationship, but now we have kids and we do some business stuff together and we do some social stuff together. We still go out there and scratch and claw each other's, you know, at each other on the tennis court. It's just, that's one of the nice things about tennis. It's a 34, going on a 35 year relationship. It's pretty neat.
So he is he German or is he an American? I thought he was German, no? Or American?
He is German, but he lived at Ball Terry's when he was 12.
Okay. Did you ever attend Voluntary?
Yeah, I used to go down there and practice. God rest his soul, Nick, the Hall of Famer, who unfortunately passed away this year, but total legend. All right, well, dude, let's do this again sometime, okay?
Yeah, man. Hey, you belong on the Jewish Mount Rushmore of athletes, in my opinion, and happy shit. I was going to say Halloween. happy
Halloween. Tonight's the last night of Hanukkah, right?
I think so. Is it tonight or tomorrow night? I'd have to check. I'd have to check with my wife on that. But yeah. Congrats on having that height. I wish I had it, man. I don't know. How did you get it, by the way? Were your parents tall? Are you just like tall?
My mom is tiny. My mom is like 5'3", 5'4", maybe 5'10". I mean, she's tiny, like 80, 90 pounds. That was a pretty big guy, like 6 feet, but I don't know.
Did you eat a lot or did you just, was
yeah,
you
just... I was, yeah, that, I mean, it is, I mean, behind, I mean, I know we're joking, but like my mom was very much ahead of her time in terms of like health food and stuff. Like, so like we always ate well, like, good food. I never had soda or candy. I don't know if that's I think genetics are a lot about maximizing. So I think maybe, and that's kind of where evolution is gone, but people are getting, I think, just whatever we did through my adolescence, whether knowing it or not, probably, I think, just helped maximize the potential of my height. But also my brother, I have two brothers. I mean, Russell's, I mean, relatively, I mean, Russell's like 6 feet, six, but my other, I have another brother who's 5'10". So it's a little bit of an outlier. And
you got all the height. You got it from them. So do you think we're going to be playing tennis like dinosaur size in like 500 years?
No, but I think you've kind of seen, you know, back when I played, you were either tall, you had some power, but you didn't move as well, or you were smaller and you move well, but didn't have power. But now you're seeing, like in all sports, like look at Kevin Durant, look at, you know, you have these, you know, you have these, you know, 6'8" point guards, right? Like in tennis, you have, I think Safin was the one to really first break through to be like the big guy who could hit off both sides and move, you know, and then now that's basically everyone, you know, you have, I mean, look, like whether it was Del Potro or, you know, but I think tennis, there's a, that's a kind of that, that middle ground of height and speed and power and speed, offense and defense that, you know, you kind of need to have. But I didn't have it.
No, you had it. You had it. Hey, there's a lot of guys out there that had huge junior careers and they didn't make anything of it. And I'm sure you know a lot of them too. But
look, and everything, you do the best you can with what you have at the time, right?
Yeah. All right, brother. We'll catch you later.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.